BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. This is an extended version of the original Radio 4 broadcast, and for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the actor Martin Freeman. A familiar face on our screens for almost 20 years, he is as prolific as he is popular, having starred in over 30 films and even more television shows. His range is remarkable, and he's often praised for the seemingly contradictory qualities of immense versatility and remarkable relatability. His talent for naturalism means audiences believe him and root for him, whatever he plays. Whether it's lovable Tim from The Office, Sherlock Holmes's brooding Watson, The Hobbit's steadfast Bilbo Baggins, or smooth CIA operative Everett K. Ross in Black Panther. He says, "I'm always praying that the next thing I read is something I'm going to love, and that can be a film, a play, or TV. For that 3-minute scene, it's my job to convince people I am that person. It's not about the form, it's about the content." Martin Freeman, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Lauren.
So given that it is about the content, what is it that makes you excited when you read it? What are you looking for?
I suppose I'm looking for a true voice, I guess. The difference between reading a script that within 6 pages has you, or one that doesn't have you, is very often when you think, well, this writer means it. If it doesn't feel like it's been written by a committee, that's good. And for my own purposes, if it doesn't feel like something that I've done 3 of in the last 2 years, that's a big thing. But I'm a big fan of, in all aspects of life, of people not begging to be liked. There's a way sometimes that scripts come across with all singing, all dancing, whistles, and begging you to like it. And I like things that are a bit more their own pace. Like, I like people who are a bit more their own pace, you know what I mean, who aren't desperate for you to approve of them all the time, you know. So I'm sort of looking for those things.
Your approach as an actor seems like it's very much show, don't tell. Would audiences be surprised by how hard you're sometimes working to create that very naturalistic performance?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's a conversation that we have as actors sometimes, and it can sound a bit self-pitying to kind of listen, because my working life is going fine, so I'm very lucky with that. But I think it's your job to not show any work. You know, if you wouldn't do it in real life, don't do it in front of a camera, you know, or on stage. And sometimes, if you are reasonably effective at that, people just think, oh, he's just doing that thing. Do you know what I mean? Or he's just doing himself or whatever. And think, well, if it was that easy, everyone would be doing it. And they're not, you know, they're not doing it. So there is a lot of work involved. But also the people who made me want to be an actor when I was a kid were people who just sort of didn't seem to be doing anything.
Like,
you know
who?
What I mean? Well, I mean, the best of Michael Caine's, like he's doing nothing, you know. So when I was 9, I didn't know there were actors like Michael Caine, because I was like, well, who's this person? Because there was something very relatable about him and very sort of very masculine without being macho. And I believed him. Do you know what I mean? I believed him. You know, or Tom Courtney, or, you know, just people who were often men who just had a bit of nuance about them, I suppose.
And two of your best-known characters that I've already mentioned, Bilbo Baggins in The Hobbit and Dr. Watson in Sherlock, they were already part of the popular canon. Mm. So many viewers coming to your performances might have had their own ideas.
Absolutely,
about those characters.
So as did I.
When you're doing something like that, how do you go about creating your version and making it something new?
Well, I suppose, in truth, I try not to do that. So I didn't actively think, how can I make my Dr. Watson different from anybody else's? Because, you know, when I was growing up, it was reruns of Nigel Bruce being Dr. Watson. It was the 40s versions of Sherlock Holmes that I grew up with. So I could never be that, because I wasn't, you know, 65 and a walrus. So whatever I was going to do was going to be slightly different. As everyone knows, casting is 75% of it. So if someone has entrusted me with that job, then I've just got to run with it and do as I think is right with the help of the director. And I mean, as soon as I was reading with Benedict, it was just different, because he was unlike any Sherlock Holmes I'd ever seen. And you make each other, you bring different stuff out of each other. Yeah.
I've read very many profile interviews with you in the run-up to today.
They're
very enjoyable. However, each one mentions two things. And the first is how private you are. The second is how much you swear. Now, I take it you've heard this show before.
Yeah, and I'm definitely not going to swear. Definitely not going to swear.
Of course, you're sharing your music with us today, and I imagine that the whittling process has been agony. Your first list was one of 15 discs, which is too many.
Yes, that's too many. I would have been happy with any of those. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's about trying not to be too cool and trying to be honest, but at the same time trying to reflect bits of your... I mean, often it's young years, isn't it? I think I was very fortunate because I was genuinely exposed to music that I still love. So, yeah, as a five-year-old, I was hearing The Clash and The Buzzcocks and The Jam. It was like, this is great, you know.
Well, let's dive straight in with your first disc then. Tell me why you've chosen this one.
Well, this was from 1977 and I would have been five turning six. I'm the youngest of five and this would have been one of the records that I inherited from my brothers. Punk was a big thing in our house. I wasn't a punk, I was a tiny child, but there was something about this album. I think it's easily one of the best debut albums ever by anybody, and I think this is one of the best opening tracks of any debut album. It's a corker.
Clash and Janie Jones. So, Martin Freeman, let's go back to the beginning. You were born in Hampshire, and as you said, the youngest of five. Your mum, Philomena, I think she was one of 14, wasn't she?
She was, yeah.
Tell me
she
about
was.
Her.
She was funny. She was rude.
rude, Harry.
I mean, not a rude person. We were all brought up, you know, well. Like, we were all brought up to have manners and be polite to people and to take other people into account. But she... Like she was quite a focus puller on her day.
Was
my
she?
Mum. Yeah, I mean,
what were her signature moves?
Because she was just quick. So in a room, she would just know that the irreverent or rude or sarcastic thing to say that would either make people laugh or make them outraged or something, you know. And she enjoyed it. And she said she knew from doing a play when she was at school, you know, she was able to tap into a thing that made people look at her. And I think what I got from my mum was this funny thing of... On the one hand, definitely being a show-off, partly going, look at me, and on the other hand, going, no, we're all equal. She was a good swearer. I think I got a lot of who I am, for better and worse, from my mum, yeah.
I think you described her in one interview that I read as creative and fantastically liberal.
Yeah, she was very liberal. She was born in the 30s, and she would have liked to have gone to drama school. So I think she found her sort of dream life really sort of through her kids, actually. And she was also chaotic and she was a bit balmy. One of the things I really took from her, especially as a parent, is you were never in any doubt you were loved, you know what I mean? And that was massively important and demonstrably so, you know. We were never afraid to tell people we loved them, do you know what I mean, and to show it. So I was very lucky in that, yeah.
And what about your dad, Geoffrey? How would you describe him?
Well, he died when I was 10, unfortunately. So I got to know him less. He'd been in the Navy as a young man and he went to art school. He was born in Hull. I associated the twin kind of loves of his life as being the sea and painting, I think, you know. My mum always described, because they split up when I was very young. And I think obviously by the end of any marriage, it's not going too fantastically well. But she said he always still had charm. He was really charming, even if he would turn up late and... in a state or whatever, because he wasn't a stranger to a drink. That was probably the triumvirate love of his life was a drink. And he was little, like me. All my brothers are taller than me. But yeah, Dad was small. I got his small gene.
Your early family sounds lively and it sounds very kind of culturally engaged. You know,
yeah,
everybody in there is living in their minds and engaging
kind
with
of,
ideas.
Yeah. And being able to sort of express it. You know, four boys and a girl, and I think we were all... We weren't afraid of being creative. I think a big part of having a creative life is just knowing you're allowed to have one. So even though without getting the violin out, we didn't have a nice car or go on holidays or any of that stuff, but whatever else you did or didn't have, you knew you were just allowed. You know, there were books in the house, there was music in the house. And so by the time I knew what I wanted to be, I knew that would be supported, which, of course, a lot of people don't have the luck of that.
And what sort of child were you?
Yeah, I was the youngest of five by a fair way. Then Jamie, the next brother up from me, is 6 years older. And by the time I came along, my parents' marriage had pretty much broken down. And I was, yeah, I was ill. I had a dodgy hip and asthma and eczema and hay fever. And all. So I was kind of, I was in and out of hospital occasionally for various things. I was quite, not leery, like, you know, not properly leery, but I was, I had a sort of confidence, I think. I just had to, you know what I mean? Because I was little for a start. So like a lot of small people, you either, well, do I fight? Probably not going to happen because I'm much smaller than everyone. Or you circumnavigate other ways around it.
And you were pretty sporty as well.
I was, yeah. I thought I was going to be a squash player until I was about 14. And I loved it until I started to not love it, you know, because it's a big commitment, a lot of training, a lot of travel.
Were you competitive?
I was, but I wasn't competitive enough. So, as we know, so much of it is having the killer instinct. I didn't have it. You know, it was best of five, so I'd be two games to love up and maybe, you know, on a match point or whatever. And I would immediately be thinking, what's this other guy feeling? You know, like, I bet he's feeling really bad now. And so that tells me in hindsight, that's much more attuned to being an actor than it is to being a champion sportsman. Yeah, I don't think John McEnroe was thinking that. I don't think Venus Williams was going, oh, poor love. You know, like, you know, you must maim everything in your wake as a sports person. And I didn't have that.
You were playing as part of the company.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really a team sport squash, you know.
It's time for some music. Tell us about your second disc today.
I remember I was in Great Ormond Street in the summer of 1980 for a hip operation. It was one of my little things wrong with me. And this was one of the records that I feel kind of changed my life, even though I was eight. I didn't have much life to change. But there were a few records on the radio at the time that I was hearing, and I was just noticing certain people dressing in a certain way and certain sounds. It was like something that was mine. And it kind of, without sounding too grand about it, I think it helped set me on a path, like literally for the rest of my life, actually. And it's Baggy Trousers.
Madness and Baggy Trousers. Martin Freeman, you've said that Catholicism and two-tone were my twin religions as a kid.
Yeah.
Plenty of drama and some cracking outfits in both.
In both, yeah.
Which should we talk about first?
Well, I suppose Catholicism predates everything, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, because that was just part of the ambience of life, I guess. Again, I was lucky in that, yeah, my mum was convent educated, but she was never unquestioning, I don't think. She was never sort of dogmatic about it.
Right.
You know, there were gay people in the family and, you know, she was always a bit of a lefty. So I grew up thinking that Catholics and Catholicism were always on the right side. I mean, as far as if you are a liberal lefty, always on the right side, you know. And so I always went to Catholic schools and...
Were you an altar boy?
Yeah, I was. Absolutely, yeah. I was an altar boy at times. But I was always naughty and I was always a smart ass. I enjoyed all of it. For me, talk about religion always gets boring. Talk about anything is boring when it's black and white and when it's just didactic and there's no grey. Because I think everything's grey. Politics, every single thing is grey. But there are things about faith and religion that I still like. Now, clearly, there are things that happen in the church and in every religion that I think, of course I'm not signed up to that. But there's something about it, and maybe it's just my childhood and maybe it's my connection with my mum, I don't know. There's something about it that I'm not prepared to jettison.
And what did you like about it as a kid? Because there's a lot going on there, isn't there? There's the sort of structure and the rhythm and also the drama, you know?
Highly theatrical.
Yeah.
I mean, Mass is a highly theatrical event. I mean, obviously, there are entertainers and creative people from every religion and none. But, yeah, it's not surprising that a lot of them are Catholics. Because, come on, you've got frocks, you've got music, you've got rehearsal,
incense,
choreography. You've got stuff to remember, you've got lines, you're a bit part player or you're the star, you know, if you're the priest, you're the star. It's pretty theatrical and I love that.
And what about two-tone? So that was, you know, religion's the grey stuff, two-tone, very much monochrome. Where did that come in?
Well, again, like that, when I was about eight or nine, you know, hearing records like, you know, like Baggy Trousers and The Selector on my radio and hearing The Specials and hearing Bad Manners. Hearing Lip Up Fatty was amazing for me. You know, Bust the Blood Vessel, it was almost literally a cartoon.
Perfect for a little
Perfect.
Bit.
It was something very direct about it. And again, I was like one of millions of kids in Britain who felt like it was speaking to me.
And what was it like for you being the youngest of five? What was your role in the family?
I don't know. See, I still feel my role is to be the youngest. I still feel, you know, everything I say they will have heard. Do you know what I mean? Like, I still kind of feel that. Have I got anything interesting to say? Because, you know, you've probably done it, you know. I don't know, I was funny. I wasn't, certainly wasn't the only funny one. I think my family's quite funny. But I think I was always quite good at that. And I wasn't the only performer either, you know. I've got musicians in the family and, of course, that's what I would have wanted to do. You know, if I'd had the talent and the wherewithal to do that, I'd much rather be a songwriter than anything else. But I can't. I don't do it.
It's an interesting thing to join a big family when it's already in full flow.
Yeah. And presumably they had, I guess they'd probably thought it was over by the time I came along. You know, I came along in 71 and it was like, well, what's this now? You know, so there wasn't much more of the marriage left when I came along, actually, you know. So, yeah, I think they had their own rhythm, probably. I don't know what my role was. I think to be small and cheeky and a bit lively. But then, as I say, it's not like I went into a family of sleepy accountants. This was quite a lively family already. None of us in my family are wallflowers.
Let's go with the music. This is your third disc today. Why have you chosen it?
Shortly, I guess, after I got into two-tone and ska, the logical thing for me to do then was just to hear other stuff and just go digging and see where this road takes you down. And, of course, an obvious road that you get to if you're into two-tone is Jamaican ska and then reggae a bit after that. And I went mad on Bob Marley and the Wailers. Like, the first album that I actually bought with my own money from a shop, one I spent $4.99 on, was a Bob Marley and the Wailers album. And then later, I heard this through my sister Laura, because she had the album Natty Dread, and this is the title track from it. It's just stunning.
Dread, Natty Dread now.
Natty Dread.
Dread like Congo Bongo.
Natty Dread.
Natty Dread like in a Babylon.
Natty Dread.
A dread like Congo Bongo. Children, get your culture. And don't stay there and just
Bob Marley and the Wailers and Natty Dread. Martin Freeman, tell me then about school. What sort of student were you?
Not a great student. I was easily distracted. I was lazy. I was unfocused. I liked English, I liked art, I liked RE. Anything that I thought that was about opinion. But I did very badly at school. I only got three GCSEs at C and above, which disappointed even me. I thought I'd get art, didn't get art. Thought I'd get history, didn't get that. I got English language and literature and RE. It's pretty bad. But I was distracted and I was a smart ass, and I, like a lot of teenagers, I thought I knew everything and I was going to tell people that I knew everything.
What were you distracted by?
Other kids, just voices in my head, which is various things, you know, like, you know, it's just more fun to be naughty. There's no way around that. Being naughty is fun.
So you acted out a bit. What about the other kind of acting? Did you do any theatre at school?
The first acting that I remember doing was actually, fittingly, for a Catholic school. We did a musical. We had a really good music teacher called Chris O'Hara, and he really encouraged me because I was quite a good percussionist. And I was obviously musical. And he did a production of a thing called The Goliath Jazz, about David and Goliath, about a sort of very 70s rock opera kind of musical about David and Goliath. And I, surprisingly, was David, given that I was about 3 foot tall. And I did it, and I was quite good at it. I remember my mum saying, because she came to see it, and she said another mum leant over to her and said, you know, he's got to do this. He should be doing this. It wasn't until I was 15 that I joined a youth theatre.
Yeah, you described that as like coming home.
Again, after a few years of thinking I was going to be a sportsman, it was much more my speed. It was much more my speed than schlepping around the country to get knocked out in the third round of some squash tournament. And here was a place you'd rehearse plays and do drama games and, you know, and clearly you were going to fancy people, and it was like, it was great.
And it sounds like it brought quite a lot of colour to your life, you know, foreign travel.
Totally, absolutely. Yeah, the first time I was ever got on a plane was to go to Berlin in 1987. We, you know, we went to East Berlin. A couple of years later, went to the Soviet Union. I first fell in love, first sort of big time I had my heart broken was there. And it gave me, it was while I was at youth theatre that I had the confidence to think I could do it.
Do you remember the moment that you first thought that?
I did a play called The Roses of Eam, which is based on a true story about a village in Derbyshire when the plague happened, the famous plague.
The bubonic one.
Yeah, the old bubo, yeah. The greatest plague. And they shut the village down so the plague couldn't leave. It was a very sort of selfless act. And of course, a lot of the village got wiped out. And I played the village idiot. He was called the Bedlam. And I remember my sister Laura had just had my niece Abby. And I remember consciously trying to use this baby as help for what I was doing. Just characteristics of a baby with not much in her head yet. And it was sort of all right. And it was reviewed in the local papers and all that. It's like, you know, this is a really good performance. And it was very gratifying from an ego point of view. So I thought I've got a shot at getting away with having a life, maybe, where I'm doing something I enjoy. And I would have been just 17 when that happened.
And what about the other pillars of teenage life, music and fashion?
I was a little mod, you know. Sort of versions of how I've been ever since, really. And getting into jazz and funk and all that sort of stuff. I couldn't go and buy loads of records, couldn't afford it. Couldn't go and buy loads of clothes, couldn't afford that. But I was definitely aware of what I wanted to look like. So a lot of trips to Oxfam for records and clothes. And if you are cursed with the thing of being obsessed with pop music from a young age, it does not leave you, I don't think. So you're always looking at what people are wearing. And you're always, you know, trying to pick up on that record or whatever. And it keeps you sort, in a way, in a state of arrested development, I think, you know what I mean? Because as other people start to grow up and get proper jobs, and also being an actor keeps you slightly in that state. Because you are basically doing what you would do for free and what children do naturally, you know, if you let them be and if they're quite happy, they play and they act, they tit around. And that's sort of a version of what I do. I mean, I would give myself slightly more credit than just doing that, but it's basically what I'm doing. And so it still leaves me space in my head to go, oh, that's a lovely pair of loafers, that. You know, whereas where I should be thinking about, have I paid the water bill? I'm still thinking about, where's that jacket from? And that has actually, if anything, got worse.
We might come to Dr. Watson's jackets later, because honestly, my other half was making a list. Every episode,
really?
It was a key part of the viewing.
I love that.
Yeah, the viewing practice.
I love that.
It's time to go to the music, though. Tell me about your next track today.
The next one is from a film that I saw when I was 14, a little while before I joined Youth Theatre. But by the time I joined Youth Theatre, I was sort of obsessed with this film, and it kind of opened my horizons a little bit to musicals, I guess. I nearly chose something from Oliver today, because I absolutely adore Oliver like a family member, right? But this just pipped it. I think it's the best musical ever, and I certainly think it's the best filmed musical ever, by a sort of embarrassingly long way, in my opinion. And I didn't know what track to choose from it, so I just chose something that's got great, fab music in it and fantastic choreography. It's from West Side Story, and it's the dance at the gym.
Dance at the Gym from the original film soundtrack of Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, performed by the West Side Story Orchestra, conducted by John Green. Martin Freeman, after a year spent working as kitchen porter, you secured a place at the Central School of Speech and Drama in London. Yeah. What were your hopes at the time?
I mean, my main hope was just to become a better actor. I really was optimistic about that. And to be among just other young actors of my generation, who were exciting and who would push me and all of that. And that did happen. I was definitely better at the end of it than I was when I started.
It was interesting that you left in your third year, though, to go and work in the National Theatre. So it seems like quite a brave choice.
No, not at all. Because if someone says to you, do you want to come and work at the National Theatre? You don't go, let me get back to you. And I left to go and work with Matthew Warchus and Jonathan Kent at the National Theatre. And I was doing very little at the National. Do you know what I mean? I was basically set dressing, you know, what they call a spear carrier, really. But you were spear carrying in the National Theatre, working with, you know, Michael Gambon and Simon Russell Beale and Diana Rigg and, you know, like proper people who you're going to go, wow, that's exciting. I was, you know, walking over the river every day just delighted, just thinking I was, to a certain degree, living the dream, even though I was hardly kind of flexing a lot of acting muscles. I was in the building. Do you know what I mean? I was actually making the rent. And I realised as soon as I got there that I had made a good career choice. I just thought, I love this. I just love it, you know.
And you did a lot of theatre after that. How did you come to move into TV work?
As every actor does, you just go for auditions for things that you do get or you don't get. Then I started auditioning for, you know, things like The Bill, which obviously everybody auditioned for at that time in the mid-90s. And that was the first TV job I got, The Bill. And
Who were you in The Bill?
I was a man called Craig Parnell. It's funny you remember these.
I love that you can still remember Craig Parnell.
I remember because I remember him having to say his name. Who are you, son? Craig Parnell.
That was great, by the way.
Thank you very much. Yeah. You can see why I got the part.
Yeah.
And I was probably quite bad in it, but it was exciting. It's the sort of thing, when you're first on telly, I was living in Bethnal Green at the time, and I remember doing that, and I did a guest lead on Casualty a couple of years later. You sort of, in your mind, again, because there were at the most five channels there, so it was a fair chance that everyone would have seen, or a lot of people would have seen the show you were on last night. You allow yourself the delusion of walking down the Hackney Road thinking, yeah, I think everyone's probably looking at me now, you know, because of Craig Parnell last night. And of course they're not, you know. But for a minute you can sort of think, oh God, I've sort of made it. Because I think whatever making it means, it's all incremental. That's why it never feels like you've made it. Because in a way I felt like I'd made it when I got into drama school in 1992. And when I'd got that call, I was like, "This, I've made it." And then the National, and then of the first bit of telly. So when people understandably talk about, you know, your breakthrough, and of course I do have breakthroughs, of course, but you kind of think, there are all lots of little ones, you know. And The Bill would probably, in my head at the time, would have been a little breakthrough.
So from Craig Parnell to Tim from The Office, tell me about auditioning for that part. Because you weren't supposed to be playing Tim.
No, I wasn't. I auditioned for Gareth, which was the part Mackenzie Crook eventually played. In my audition was Asher Taller, the producer, and Steve Merchant, the co-creator. And I'd already worked with Ricky Gervais before. He had written on a sketch show I'd done called Bruiser, which had people like Olivia Colman and Mitchell and Webb and Matt Holness in it. And so I'd met Ricky, thought he was hilarious. And also hilarious in a way that I'd never met anyone else in showbiz be hilarious. You met people in the playground who are hilarious like that, but not anyone at the BBC who is funny in that particular way. But I remember us talking during Bruiser, and I think he thought I was quite good. And, you know, and that was in a good cast of people. And I'd read for Gareth. And it does sound like such a sort of showbiz story, but as I was leaving the room, I'd opened the door, and then I can't remember whether it was Steve Merchant or Ash said, should we get Martin to read for Tim? Maybe that's going to be a better fit. And so I went, oh, OK, yeah. And so I read for Tim, and thank God that went all right. Yeah. And the rest is history. But yeah, obviously that made a massive difference to my life, doing that show.
All right, well, we'll talk more about that after the next track. It's your fifth disc today. Why have you chosen it?
Because there's no way you can't have the Beatles in it. For me, I love a lot of music, like you do, Lauren, but I just can't think of a better band, so it would just be rude not to have them. And out of all the scores and scores of songs that I could have chosen, this one still, to me, sounds fresh as a daisy. It came out in early 67. It still, to me, slightly sounds like the future. And it's by the best band that's ever lived, and it's Strawberry Fields Forever.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields.
The Beatles and Strawberry Fields Forever. So, Martin Freeman, The Office would go on to become Britain's most successful TV series in a decade, the first British sitcom to win a Golden Globe. What was that success like for you at the time?
The success was amazing because it was off the back of a show that I'd loved, you know. So it was a double whammy of having really, really enjoyed doing the show and been very proud of it myself and laughed probably more than I've ever laughed since or before on any job, but to have it then sort of validated by so many people who we respected as well was amazing. For a sort of 3 years, we just sort of went to award shows and cleaned up everywhere. You know, it was weird because it kind of felt like for a period we were very loved. It's nice.
In 2010, you got the part of John Watson in Sherlock. How did your audition for that show go?
Well, the first one didn't go so well. I auditioned on my own. And I've read since, or someone's told me since, that I had said that I just got my wallet nicked or something on the way. And I can't remember actually having my wallet nicked, but I don't think I was in a great mood for whatever reason.
Yeah, I've got a quote here. Mm. They thought I was a moody prick.
Yes. Yeah, I think they probably did. And I didn't quite know they'd thought that until a couple of weeks later, Michael, my agent, rang me. We were talking about something else. I said, oh, well, do you know what's happening with Sherlock? Because I was still waiting to hear. And he said, well, yeah, to be honest, mate, they didn't really feel you were that up for it. They didn't get a good vibe from you that you really cared that much about it. And I said, oh, my God, no, I really do care. Because I'd read the first episode and I thought it was brilliant. So I said, well, can you please tell them that I really do care? And if they want me to read again, I'll read again, you know. And it was a good lesson that, you know, as I said earlier, I'm not massively into begging to be liked, but sometimes it can go too far the other way if people think, oh, he doesn't care. Fair enough, we'll just go to someone else. And I really wanted it. So I read again. I went in with Benedict. And when we read, it was easy. I think whatever our natural rhythms are kind of clipped in with each other.
I mean, that chemistry is an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Isn't it? How rare is it that you have that experience, that it just works straight away?
I think fairly rare, yeah, and certainly even rarer for it to be picked up in the sort of public in that way. Probably nothing I've done, maybe nothing I ever will do, has resonated with certain parts of the world's population the same way Sherlock has. It just kind of hit a lot of buttons for people. And it's overwhelming at first. You know, when it first happens, you're just delighted. Again, because similarly to The Office, it was a show that I was immensely proud of.
It's quite intense, though. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, you mean that reaction can be quite intense? Definitely. Yeah, the reaction can be quite intense. You know, my job is very, very different from being a pop star, obviously. But I liken it to a pop group because, you know, that's the thing that I got most passionate about, where you throw in all your cards with this band, whatever, or with this singer. And that's what a lot of people did with Sherlock, which on the one hand is really, really gratifying. And on the other hand, is a lot to live up to.
You know what I mean?
Because you cannot live up to it. You just can't. So by the time we filmed the last ones, there were some fans who were so adamant. They knew that John and Sherlock were gay. They knew it. And they knew that Stephen and Mark were going to write an episode where we, you know, held hands off into the sunset together. And so when that didn't happen, there was, you know, there was a chunk of people going, this is betrayal. You know, Dylan going electric or whatever. I think some people, put it this way, they invest a lot in it. And up to a certain point, that's delightful. Beyond a certain point, it's more challenging.
And how did you cope with the challenge?
As I always do, which is going home and playing records. What I always do. And, you know, keeping your head down and doing the things that you can trust in.
Yeah.
You know, which is being a dad and, you know, being normal. Doing stuff that is not to do with your job.
You were also working on screen with your then partner, Amanda Abington. Mm. What was it like working together? Because you met on set, I think.
We met on a set in 2000. We met on a Channel 4 drama called Men Only. And we clicked immediately. We just hit it off. We went on a date a day or two later. And we were together for 16 years. So she was and remains one of my favourite actors. I think she's a fantastic actor. I always knew I wasn't the best actor in my house. You know what I mean? So, yeah, nothing pleases me more than her success over the last sort of 7 or 8 years.
What was it like working together on Sherlock?
Awful. No, it was good. It was good. I really love working with her. You know, by the time of the last Sherlock that we've done, we were sort of in the midst of splitting up. So that wasn't that much fun. But when we weren't in that midst, it was great. You know, I still laugh a lot with Amanda. You know, she's a very, very funny woman.
And as I've got you in this room, on behalf of the internet, I have to ask, do you think there will be more Sherlocks?
I honestly, I don't know. Everyone knows, because it's been well documented, that it's a big logistical thing to get us all together. I think we all love the show. We all are really proud of the show. But, you know, listen, I didn't write the last script, and the last of that series definitely felt like a pause. I can't speak for anybody else, but I think we're all sort of the opinion that if it's right, we'll do it. You know, which sounds like a sort of hedgy thing to say, but it's true. And what I learned from The Office, it's quite good to not go on forever. You know what I mean?
It's time to hear your next track. Why have you chosen this one?
I was walking with Amanda around St Albans Cathedral, and I was with my mum and stepdad, James, and the four of us were just walking around the grounds, and we heard from inside the cathedral this beautiful music coming. And we popped our heads in the door, and it was a choir rehearsing. And we sat down in a pew because we thought, oh, we're getting some free music. It's beautiful. And it was so beautiful. And it was like one of those moments that was really, that I never forget. Because when you do hear something pure and human and kind of timeless and something that's lasted a couple of hundred years, there is something in that. And when you're hearing it in a beautiful, because St. Albans Cathedral, if you haven't been, is absolutely stunning place. It felt like a real, like a little private gift we were getting. And it's Henry Purcell, When I Am Laid in Earth.
When I Am Laid in Earth, from Henry Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, sung by Lynn Dawson with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by René Jacobs. So, Martin, as you mentioned, you and your former partner, Amanda Abington, announced a very amicable separation after 16 years together a while ago. How have you adjusted to co-parenting?
Pretty well, really. I think it's true what people have always said. As long as your kids know... Because my parents were divorced, but I knew I was loved. You know, when I was never thinking me and Amanda were going to split up, I always knew that people who split up and can be civil and do it for the kids, it's all right. I didn't only want to be civil for the children, I wanted to be civil for us. Because when you've loved someone for that long and they've been such an integral part of your life, what, that's supposed to just not count now? That just didn't make sense to me. So, yeah, we do get on well, and I think the kids see us getting on well, and that's a massive thing. They're just loved by the same two people in different geography now.
Your new project, Breeders, which is going out in 2020, is all about parenting and being a dad. What is it that you wanted to say about the subject?
I developed it with Simon Blackwell and Chris Addison.
Peep Show and Veep.
Yes, yeah. No slouches themselves. And the point of it was sort of to let parents out of a jail that they think they're in if they've ever sworn at their kids or ever just wanted to throw everyone in their family out of the nearest window, you know. All the things that I felt you couldn't say at nice North London dinner parties or whatever, or admit to. It's not all that, but the genesis of it was... Not only is that all right to have felt that, but it's if you're being honest, it's sort of obligatory. At some point you will have... Because how could you not? I thought I was a really nice person until the age of 34, when I thought, oh, no, you're quite spoiled and quite impatient. So, yeah, I mean, one of my children's mantras to me now, you know, they're 10 and 13, is, Daddy, be patient. Just be patient. I'm like, yeah, I know. And, you know, the difference between not being a parent and being a parent is about 47 light years. There's no manual for it, and you are not prepared for how viscerally challenging it is. I'd never felt such rage in my life as when I became a parent. Now, also, of course, I'd never felt such love. The interesting thing is for men, I think in the last generation, is we are, a lot of us, not everyone, but a lot of us are trying to parent in a way for which we have had no example at all. There's been a more steady example of what it is to be a mother, generally speaking. Now, in the last generation, we're trying to catch up with that with no experience, with no blueprint for that at all. So guess what? It's going to be messed up a lot of the time, you know. And I think if we're not messing it up, we're sort of lying about it a lot of the time. I knew it in my head, this will be hard and it'll be wonderful. But what I wasn't prepared for was my own shortcomings, because they'd never been tested like that. And listen, we're making a comedy programme. We're not making a public health sort of broadcast. But I do think it's useful to be able to tell people, men and women, yeah, you know how you want to, and sometimes do occasionally shout at your children. Yeah, of course we know it's not great, but what do you think people were doing 50 years ago? Like, what do you think your parents were doing?
And what was it like thinking about, you know, yourself as a father, and then presumably by extension, thinking about your own dad, your stepdad, the dynamics in your family?
Well, yeah, I mean, Chris, Simon and I, you know, it was like a men's self-help group, and it was that. And we all had fairly, not the same experience, but we had similar experiences. I look back on things that now happen, you think, there's just no way. There's no way you would do that now. That were totally normal 35 years ago. Well, having a very, very asthmatic child, but no one would even think about stopping smoking in front of them. Do you know what I mean? Like, what is this then? It's just weird. Asthma's not getting any better, you know what I mean?
And what kind of parent are you?
A work in progress. I try my best. I think I'm very, very demonstrably loving. We're a very, very tactile, kissy, huggy family. There's a lot of telling each other we love each other. And a lot of shouting as well. Yeah.
Let's have some more music. This is your seventh disc today. Tell me about this one.
This is the Style Council, and they were a very, very big band for me growing up. More than the Jam, actually. I think the highs of the Style Council are so beautiful. And it opened up my ears to different things. It opened up my ears to different sounds and different influences and things. And I think as a sort of top 10 pop band in the 1980s, they were smuggling a lot of lyrics in to the top 10. They really were. Because it was with, you know, great melodies, really, really musical, catchy stuff that was about, you know, bringing down the Thatcher government. And I'm not necessarily that animal now. I'm not massively party political now. I am a bit, but I was 13 when it came out. And for years, I thought, this is what I'm going to have at my funeral. Because it hit me very, very hard. I'm
The Style Council and Walls Come Tumbling Down. Martin Freeman, we're about to cast you away. How do you greet the prospect of total solitude on a desert island?
Not great, because I like knowing people are around. I do like people. I do in theory.
Is practice different?
Yeah, of course it is. But there are a lot of people I do like. But a lot of life is quite annoying, without trying to sound like a comedy stand-up grumpy old man. So in that sense, having a bit of peace would be good. But never hearing anyone else's voice would be horrendous, awful. Yeah, I don't look forward to that.
Tell me a little bit about your attitude to fame, because you seem to have quite a healthy disregard for it, and I find that really interesting. Where do you think that comes from?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it would come from upbringing, I suppose. It might come from partly being the youngest of five and thinking, I'm always aware, don't get too past your station. I'm always thinking that. I don't know whether I've always succeeded in it. That is honestly a low-level hum all my life. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, all my life, really. I think it's that. And also just seeing it is so unattractive when you see other people fall for it. Of course, there are things to be enjoyed about fame. Of course there are. You know, and you'd be, I think, silly. And I have been silly at some points just not to enjoy it. I do have. That is a problem for me sometimes. I forget I'm allowed to enjoy stuff like that. Or I'm quite Spartan like that. I'm a bit monkish sometimes with that. It's probably not because I'm a saintly person. It's just because I don't want to look rubbish, you know.
But you're missing out potentially on some really nice dinners.
Potentially. But I'm never happier than when I'm either at my house or someone else's house who I know and love and trust. That's when I feel really, really safe. Mm-hmm. And I think I've always felt, way before I was famous, I think I felt that slightly about being out. And that just sort of got compounded by being well known, because then you know people, especially in this day and age where people can just take pictures of you and do take pictures of you and record you and all that. It's intrusive and I don't like it. I can just about bear it for me. I can't bear it for my kids, you know. I woke up this morning to someone had papped me and the kids in my road pretty much. It's just annoying. I don't know. What is there possibly to enjoy about that, you know? And why would you open your life up to it? by sort of bringing your kids into the public eye before they're ready? I personally don't get it at all. Because we all know once you've brought it out of the box, you can't put it back in.
And how are you about getting older? Because we were talking earlier during one of the tracks about the fact that, you know, you always kind of tally yourself against the musicians that you admire, maybe more than actors.
I'm all right with it. As everyone says, you know, you're a bit horrified sometimes when you look in the mirror and think, oh, wow, this is what we're doing now. We've come to this. And then other days you feel 17, you know, because of the spirit that's in you. I'm in a very, very lucky position that I've still got a lot of things to be grateful for. And there's a lot of things going well for me now. But let's be honest. I mean, being 24 is pretty good. Don't you think?
Yeah. Time for your last disc, Martin Freeman. Tell me about this one.
When I went to drama school, I was so obsessed with Stevie Wonder. I was kind of a little Stevie evangelist for a lot of people. I'd always do people tapes and, you know, mixtapes and stuff and introduce people to different music. And a lot of it was Stevie Wonder at the time. He kind of produced a body of work between, let's say, really 72 to 76, 77, that I think for the 70s does a similar thing to what the Beatles did in the 60s in terms of pushing boundaries, in terms of him just functioning at full power as a creative force. I could have chosen so many things, but yeah, this is from Inner Visions from 1973, when he was 23. It's a wonderful song. It's Jesus, Children of America.
Hello, Jesus, Jesus, children. Jesus loves you, Jesus, children. Hello, children, Jesus loves you of America. Are you hearing what he's saying? Are you feeling what you're praying? Are you hearing, praying, feeling what you say inside?
Stevie Wonder and Jesus, Children of America. Martin Freeman, the time has come then for me to give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare.
Thank you. I know both off by heart, of course.
Well, yeah. Naturally. Mm. You can also take a book of your own choosing. What would you like?
I would take, and this is a tough one as well, but just for the sheer effect it had on me when I first read it, I'm going to take Animal Farm by George Orwell. So I read it when I was 11, and it had a similar sort of thing to Two Tone, I think. It struck me like a lightning bolt, and it got me interested, even more interested in history, the history of the left, I suppose. I read it every few years, and I've never read anything that hit me like that, ever.
What about your luxury item?
Tea-making facilities, because, and I'm aware how clichéd and English that sounds, but it's true, I like tea. And tea is way more than a drink, it has symbolic and emotional purposes. There was a reason that in the war, people would just think everything's going to be all right with a cup of tea. I still sort of think that. It's a comforting thing, putting the kettle on.
Well, we're not supposed to be too practical, but I suppose if you have a cultural context with which you're bringing this request to me, I could give you solar-powered tea-making facilities to explore the kind of cultural ritual.
Well, I think it's an inherent part of my Englishness. Let's have that.
All right, that'll do. And finally, I know this might be very difficult. If you could only keep one of these discs, which would it be?
Oh, blimey. I think I'd avoided this question in my head. Can I just say, Lauren, you know this is impossible, don't you?
Yeah.
Fine. Listeners, you know this is impossible. Okay, but today, as you're asking me today, and it could be different next Tuesday,
right.
I'm going to say the Beatles just because I can't think of anyone better. That's all. It's one of the greatest records of the last century. By the, I think, the primary creative force of the century, I think.
Well, then you can have it.
Thanks.
Martin Freeman, thank you so much for sharing your Desert Island Discs with us.
Thank you, Lauren.
As we leave Martin making a brew, let me bring you another gem from the Desert Island Discs back catalogue. Of course, Martin starred in The Office with Ricky Gervais, and in 2007, Kirsty talked to him about his sense of humour.
Tell me then, Ricky Gervais, was there a sort of family sense of humour? I mean, I know you didn't want to overplay the idea of sort of poverty and we didn't have much, but one of the things that can bind working class families together especially is a lot of laughs.
That was the most important thing. Outside having a job, you know, you had to have a job. Doesn't matter what you earned, but you had to have a job. If you had a job, you were allowed to have a laugh. That was what it was all about.
Was there a sense of competitiveness in the humour? I mean, did somebody always want to be the one who got the last line in?
Yeah, but you respected if you had a go. If you crumbled, you'd lost. And if you came back with a good one,
it could be devastating, but they'd have to laugh. You know, it was an engagement, and you'd shake hands afterwards and go, good one.
Who set the tone for that? Was it your father?
No, my father was very dry. He said, you know, one thing a day. But I suppose my next oldest brother, Bob, was the one that instigated most things. He was just he just said funny things, you know, in there's nowhere he wouldn't go.
What about boundaries? Because between people who know each other very well, of course, you can go where people don't normally go, people you don't know as well. You know, you can just take the humour to places that might be considered a bit risky.
Well, when my mum died, we were organising the funeral, and my the vicar said to my brother, so tell me about your mother. What was she like? And my brother, just winding up the vicar, said, she was a keen racist. And the vicar said, well, I can't say that. He went, oh, OK, then she liked gardening. And then when we were at the funeral, so there's me, my brother Bob, my sister Marsha, and our oldest brother, Larry, who'd come down from Scotland. But my brother had played a trick on him as well, because the vicar suddenly goes, Ava leaves behind four loving children, Ricky, Bob, Marsha and Barry. And Larry just turns around and looks, and we're crying with laughter. And the vicar thinks we're crazy, that we're there crying and crying with laughter.
But apart from, I mean, there is a question about whether or not, of course, we use humour as a reflex to protect us from things, and where more than a funeral are you going to feel the pain of a parent dying? But also, I mean, for me, I find those very funny stories. For a lot of people, though, there, you've strayed into the bounds of absolute tastelessness and disrespect.
But definitely not. But absolutely...
Definitely not, because everybody is participating. And
everyone, you know, knew what they thought of Mum, and we worried about what the vicar thought.
Right.
I remember, I think it was at my dad's funeral where we're mucking around and laughing, and Bob had to go over to the vicar and say, sorry about that. He said, you know, he was 83. If he was 50, there'd have been less laughter. And that sums it up. You know, he'd had a good life, and it was exactly what they would have wanted, I think.
The stuff that you were saying about your mother's funeral, though, there's very much a sense in which that reflects the idea that there is nowhere you won't go for laugh. I mean, is that for you also a professional dictum, that wherever you think you will make people smile, that is where you're willing to travel for a joke or a good line?
Well, yes, but you've got to be, you know, I wouldn't do it at someone else's mum's funeral. You know, I think that's the difference. But I don't think there's any taboos in humour. It's where the humour comes from. Humour comes from a good or a bad place.
So context is all.
Of course. Of course. Yeah.
The wonderful Ricky Gervais speaking to Kirsty in 2007. Desert Island Discs is taking its usual 5-week Easter break now, and to keep you going in the meantime, you'll find an amazing cast list of actors and comedians, musicians and scientists on BBC Sounds. I'll be back on May the 12th when I'm delighted to say my guest will be Louis Theroux. Do join us then.
You know the way late at night, in bed, in the dark, your tired mind can wander and strange thoughts float like balloons escaping into the sky? Well, Bunk Bed is a podcast where Peter Curran and Patrick Marber find the nearest faraway place from the hurly-burly of daily life where tired minds can wander. Why don't you come along and eavesdrop and see if you like it? You can subscribe to Bunk Bed on BBC Sounds.